This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Hi everyone, I'm here in the studio with Dr. Martin Stringer from the Observatory de Paris. He was a colloquium speaker this week in JVCA and he agreed to be jodcasted. Thank you for joining us, Martin. So your talk was about going ballistic principle of supernova winds. So just from the start, tell us a little bit about supernova and how do you use them?
Well, to understand the galaxy population, we're interested in the cumulative effect of many supernovae over the lifetime of the galaxy. And one of the biggest effects they have on galaxies is to remove the gas, which might otherwise get turned into stars. And the amount of gas they remove, where it ends up, the energetics of the whole process are very interesting, and it's possible to understand quite a lot about them without doing physics that you might not have encountered at A-level or even at GCSE.
Brilliant. Okay. So you're interested in... So you have a lot of gas in the galaxy. You start forming new stars. Then you have supernova. They have really strong winds, and with these winds, you remove the gas. So the star formation rate changes.
Yeah, if you were to try and model a galaxy population without including them, you'd reach some conclusions which are quite inconsistent with what we observe. There are many other effects which could influence this, but supernovae can provide a large amount of the explanation.
Okay, so what are you observing supernovae in different galaxies? How do they?
Well, the first thing that you need to understand if you're to explain this is the energy that's actually available from each supernova and hence all of them put together. And this is quite difficult. Most of our knowledge is empirical. We have very sophisticated ways of doing this now by looking at the light curve, or rather the way that the light from the supernova changes with time. But the first time we started to get a handle on this was by looking at remnants of supernovae which went off hundreds of years ago. So, in fact, we were able to find what was left of a star that exploded in 1573. And it was observed by quite a famous astronomer called Tycho Brahe. This is one example of many. And it was found in 1967. The remnant of this, which by then had expanded to an enormous distance, comparable to the distance from here to the next star. And simply by looking at that distance and dividing by the 400 years, you have a sense for how fast this enormous body of gas is moving, and hence you can estimate quite accurately the energy that the star must have provided to accelerate this material up to these speeds. And then if you allow correctly for how many of these you would estimate to go off in the lifetime of the galaxy. Now, in our galaxy, this is about one a year, but it's been around for many billions of years.
Yeah.
Then you find that this is enough energy to have ejected a large fraction, a half perhaps, maybe as much as hundreds, as 99% of the gas and removed that from the system.
Oh, wow. So what happened to this gas? This gas goes into the...
Observationally, there's support for it to have left the entire region of each galaxy or galaxies, and it would be in the intergalactic medium. Yes.
Brilliant. Wow. And so the one that hasn't left, I'm guessing it doesn't have enough escape velocity to leave the galaxy, then it will just... go back to the galaxy. So it's kind of like a feedback.
Yeah, so there's quite a lot of work being done on that as well. The term that we use for that is galactic fountain, because in a system like the Milky Way, our own galaxy, which is a bit bigger, so the gravitational influence on the gas is bigger, we expect, and people have modelled this at Oxford in some detail, that the material will be launched out of the disk of the galaxy, but then fall back in again. And the fact that it falls back in a slightly different position can explain quite a lot of the observed distribution of stars in the galaxy. So this is actually quite recent work by my former colleagues at Oxford.
Brilliant. That's pretty amazing. So in your talk, you also mentioned, because you're doing like you did like a numerical analysis and simulations, right? So How did they compare and what were the results?
Well, yeah, I think Martin Rees famously mentioned that galaxy formation theory was a bit like mud wrestling. He's comparing it to traditional theoretical physics, which is a bit more elegant, perhaps like fencing or judo or something with a much more elegant set of rules, whereas mud wrestling is a bit more improvised. I think he has a point. I think you see this in the action films these days, that it's not like the old James Bond films where it's sort of like English boxing. You know, I mean, these days that they have all the necessary training, but they're not above, you know, just sort of throwing a pencil case at their adversary if it means that they get away. And I think when we're attacking this problem, certainly in our research group, we're very keen to have very detailed numerical simulations of the process to help us understand and to back up our arguments. To have both highly advanced, sophisticated numerical models and also very simple explanations using physics, which almost anyone can get to grips with, to understand at least the first order behavior of the galaxy population. And then if we want to try and get into more detail and understand any particular system with peculiar qualities, then we can use more sophisticated modeling techniques. But we like to have both a broad explanation which is satisfactory and easy to understand, and then also the incredibly detailed explanation for specific cases.
Right. So what did you find then when you compare them?
in our relatively simple model, we have a picture where each supernova that goes off will take with it a body of gas which is constrained by momentum conservation, which is something that most people come across at school during their GCSEs, perhaps, or maybe even earlier. So it's a fundamental piece of physics which is governing the evolution of the supernova remnants. And then at some much later stage, there's a phase which is primarily governed by energy conservation, and that's where going ballistic in the title of the colloquium came from, because a ballistic particle is something which is moving only under gravity. So a ballista is that enormous catapult thing which the Romans used to smash down enemy castles.
Right.
And so if you imagine the movement of one of those great boulders, that's a very bad description of a supernova explosion in the early phases. But later on, when it's got out of the galaxy and it's moving and the gas is moving away, perhaps it is a good enough description to provide a satisfactory first order description. And this approach was forwarded in the 1970s as a way of understanding the gas content of galaxies. And we've modified that to allow for, correctly, we hope, for the earlier stages of the evolution. And we have also run the highest resolution numerical simulations that we can to try and see if they support this idea as well.
Very good.
Yes, would you be skeptical about this? Or
Well, no, because your fits were pretty good, apart from the dwarf galaxies one that you said that.
Yeah, the dwarf galaxies, the very smallest galaxies, are right at the limit of whether the galaxies can form at all. So the way that our simple explanation for supernovae, based on ideas from 30 or 40 years ago, the way that these simple approximations work is to assume that the gas can accumulate into the galaxy effectively. Now, for the very smallest systems, that's not going to be true. And all this and many other aspects of the problem are really ultimately governed by the structure of the hydrogen atom.
Right.
So below a certain temperature, it's very, very difficult for the atoms to radiate any energy. So they will sit out in the halo that surrounds the galaxy. The corona is another name for it. They will sit there quite happily for very, very long periods without radiating any energy, and so they won't fall into the center and form a galaxy, or certainly not as effectively as they would if they were in a larger region and hence a bit hotter. And actually, as well as that, the structure of the hydrogen atom will influence the amount of momentum that is carried along with the supernova remnants, because that will affect how that gas radiates energy as well. And in fact, the reason we can see the remnant, for example, the one we talked about earlier, is because it is radiating energy. So it's actually at the phase that we're interested in. It's not in a. It's not conserving the energy that was given to it by the exploding star, but it will have to conserve momentum. So that links in with what we were saying earlier.
Yeah. So, in terms of the different galaxies that you can observe everywhere, does the wind coming from the supernova, does it know that it's living in a dwarf galaxy? Does it know, like, the environment around it?
Well, the supernova itself, I think the answer has to be, to first order, no. How can it know on the scale that is important to the evolution of the stellar remnant what type of galaxy it's in? Now, of course, the environment that they might on average find themselves will vary. So that is something that we need to allow for. But we're hoping that if we pick the right phase in the remnant to characterize the momentum and the energy that's available, then that might be more or less the same in any galaxy. And then it's the later part of the evolution, when the gas tries to escape, where the system that it's in will become really important. So this is one way of making the explanation very simple and accessible, if you can divide it into these two phases. And more advanced modeling can determine eventually whether or not this approximation is going to work.
Yeah, it's cool. The other thing I was thinking is, do you have well, I'm guessing it evolves with time, right? So in a galaxy, you have supernova goes off, some gas you will lose, some gas it will come back, and then you have another supernova and another, but you are losing gas all the time, I'm guessing, right? And either this gas is going into smaller stars or bigger stars, or even when the supernova goes boom and ejects a lot of gas. Is it like the escape velocity will be less and less and less because you have less mass? Or
which velocity?
From the gas. So the velocity of the gas when it's ejected.
Well, as you said earlier, it's probably quite true that close to where the supernovae go off, you wouldn't expect there to be any difference from one galaxy to the next, regardless of what type of galaxy that was. So initially, the velocity of the material will be the same in all systems. But later on, it will, in the bigger systems, have decelerated a lot more because of the greater gravitational pull from a larger galaxy. So we would expect to see higher velocity winds in smaller systems than the same distance from larger systems.
Yeah, but I mean, in the same system, evolving from...
In the same system, there will be a huge range of speeds, dependent on all sorts of things. The location of the star within the galaxy, the density of the gas surrounding it, and many other effects. But what we would like to do to effectively model the whole population and understand its properties is integrate effectively over all these different possibilities, which over an entire lifetime of a galaxy might well be quite accurate.
Yeah. From your research, from your perspective, where do you think is going? What else do you have to... I mean, well, apart from putting a lot of parameters in your models and make it better.
Well, the goal would be to take parameters out of the models.
Right, make them simple.
Again, characterizing the two methods for modeling, the analytic method where you're trying to have as fewer parameters in your model as possible, and ideally the whole thing would be possible to do the whole thing with a pen and paper, because your understanding of the physics is such that you can predict the emergent phenomena that we see from first principles. So any parameters that are in there would have to be made up entirely of fundamental constants, but with as few equations as possible. And then with a numerical model, what you want to do is to put in the most fundamental physics that you can. And so you're not bothered about how many equations you are, you're just bothered about how fundamental they are. So the perfect simulation would be to have every single particle in the model. Whereas the perfect analytic model would have zero particles. It would just write, you'd just be able to write down the answer. Now, of course, neither of these is possible, but that shows you the extremes to which each type of modeling process is striving. So our goal is to do both. We want to be able to reproduce fully all the fine complexity of the process by a really, really well-designed numerical model. And then what we also want to do is to be able to explain in a very, very elegant and very accessible way some of the observed properties by doing as much maths as we can ourselves. Sometimes with the aid of a computer, but not relying on it for the answer, so that the final answer just depends on the fundamental physics that we know is responsible for what we're seeing, or we think it is.
Yeah. I remember one of the questions that you were asked was about AGN feedback.
Yes.
Yeah, so how do you treat that?
Well, certainly that's an entire interview in itself, and you might want to get someone else on the microphone.
Yeah.
But clearly, to get the full picture, that's got to be included. But it's quite important, I think, to understand the effects and the importance of one thing at a time.
Yeah,
otherwise, even the readers that will read the full article in the scientific journal will just get a little bit lost about the relative importance of all these different things. And also, as modelers, it's difficult to stay honest if you're allowed to include any effects at any point to solve any problem. So what we really wanted to do is get back to some of the traditional work that had been done in this field and see to what extent that was still valid. And whether there is clear evidence that we needed to revise our ideas on this. And there are regimes in the galaxy population where supernovae are much more important than AGN. For example, in many galaxies, the AGN are not there at all.
So we're
certainly aware of the need to include both, but are very keen to fully understand each independently as well.
Very good. Well, thank you very much for the interview.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. I hope I haven't waffled too much.
No. Thank you.